I got bills to
move. Yes, I got it.
And just so you know, I also have a...
You have to go somewhere.
Okay. That's fine. I also have a committee to testify in front of.
All right, so this must be a national thing. It's called
Cornerstone Auto
Brokers.
In different places.
Got it.
Okay, I'm going to call to order the meeting of the House Education Committee for March 27th, 2009. And I'm first going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2575. And I'm also going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2788. And I'm opening these hearings immediately because we have representatives to speak to these bills and they have other commitments. So, Senator Berger, would you like to start? Senator, did I say Senator Berger? Sorry.
Thank you, members of the committee.
Okay. Smith, shall we hear about the bill first? Thank you.
Members of the committee, Vice Chairman Dembro, this bill, I'll be very brief, establishes the Oregon Scholars Program with the Oregon Student Assistance Commission, requires the commission to issue awards to the extent funds are available for Oregon scholars who receive a diploma from a high school or are honorably discharged, earned a grade point average of 3.5 or better in high school, is a resident of the state of Oregon, and has not achieved a baccalaureate or higher degree. There's also a renewal provision that's allowed with respect to this. The bill permits the commission also to adopt the necessary rules in terms of priority when funds are not available and set standards regarding community service.
Okay, Representative Berger.
Thank you, Vice Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Vicki Berger, State Representative, District 20. This bill, I hope, will start a conversation in a direction that I think we need to start going. And that notion is, in our desperate times, the people that we need the most in this state and in this country are our top students. We need their intellectual capital, we need their energies, and we need them to be thinking on the way out of the wilderness we're in. And so the question that kind of comes to mind is, Oregon has great resource, and this is a resource. How do we capitalize on it and keep it here? So there are, I'm aware, and there are plenty of experts who could give you in the weeds description of embedded systems within our current system to help our top students. There's high school things like international baccalaureate programs. There are scholarships within both the community college and the higher ed. There are all kinds of kind of not exactly cogent, but ways that we help these students. I think what I'm looking for in this bill is for us to start thinking about how we could bring these into some sort of a systematic way of making sure that these students are recognized and encouraged, that sends a signal out to the global community that Oregon has and values top educational students, and that they're here as part of our mix, which I think, you know, sells us in many ways outside of here. And at the same time, it says to these students, we want you here, and we want you to stay here. And that's why there's sort of a, what if we required them to work in our state? If they got a scholarship, would they work in our state, you know, so many months or something? This bill is not a finished product. I don't intend it to be. I have heard, you know, various groups who want, you know, who understand how little scholarship money there is in this world are alarmed that I'm trying to undermine something they're trying to do. That is not my intention. I want us to start thinking about how we can create an Oregon Scholars System that says to our bright students, we value you, we want you, and we're going to help you get educated, and what says to the global community, we have smart, bright people in this state. Come and join us and bring workforce beings here, okay? And so this is the start of a conversation, not a finished bill. I have, by the way, since this has come out, had conversations with a couple of our young freshmen who are kind of closer to higher ed than I am in terms of the chronological order of things. And they said, boy, we've been thinking about the same thing. So I ask that you start this conversation here today. And in order to sort of frame the kind of thinking that got me on this, I have invited some folks from Chemeketa Community College, which is my community college, who had started this in a systematic way at their college, and they can tell you. I just thought I'd invite them to come and just so you understand what they're doing and how it's working for them, so you'd have some sort of a modeling in your mind as you think about this. And that's what I'm asking on this bill. I'm happy to answer questions.
Okay. Thank you for introducing this, Representative Berger. Anybody on the committee have questions of the representative? Representative Comp.
Tough one.
Thank you, Vice Chair Dembro. Representative Berger, thank you for bringing this. Have you researched what other states have done?
Yes, I didn't mention this, but there are the most well-known is the HOPE Amendment in Georgia. If you're not aware, Georgia had a huge renaissance in the 90s in terms of its sort of global positioning. And one of the things that they did was this type of program where they scholarshiped students. It's quite a bit bigger than what I'm considering for Oregon at this time. But Indiana has one. Vermont has. I mean, this is not some new out there idea. And I think it's time for Oregon to start thinking how we could take this idea and make it an Oregon idea.
Yes. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I would think that we probably could get a staff member somewhere to do a little research to find out how this has worked in other states, because I have too heard of this, but I haven't seen any data if they were able to keep it, if they started up in an economic good time or bad time, and then if they were able to keep it up, it would be interesting to track the results.
Yeah, and my research has been limited to what staff I have going on the web and talking to a lot of people.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Yes, Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Representative Beyer, I think one of the concerns expressed by some of the students in the university system today is that it might impact the impact what's available in the opportunity grants. And so they're concerned that this may lock out some of the lower income kids. So do you have any idea?
Here is my comment on that. Okay. This is not an either or proposition. Okay, what we should be doing is both. And I know we have very limited resources, but let me give you one other model that you might think about. When I was growing up and you were growing up in the 50s and 60s, the model for a country that was completely without hope was India. Huge population, huge poverty, huge religious. They were a country that I was taught was going to fall off the end of the earth economically. But somewhere along the line, they decided that they had a lot of smart people, and they started doing merit scholarships for some of these poverty-driven people. And I can tell you that I have seen a transformation in their economic prospects based on a lot of factors, but that's one of them. That is one of them. So I'm not saying we totally duplicate the India model or anything like that, but we got to start thinking about that. They did it merit-based all the way, and only the best get in, and it's very competitive. That's sort of anathema to our notion that everybody gets a place at the table, but boy, was it effective. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I just would put that on the table as the kind of thinking that they still have huge poverty. They still have all these massive problems. But their economic prospects have been immensely improved. And partly it's because they've invested in human capital at the top.
Okay, Representative Roblin.
Yeah, just a quick one, and mostly a comment. If we don't do it, other states are already doing it to our students. Alaska has a program that any student that has XYZ, SATs and other things, they will give them a scholarship to come to Alaska. There are other states that are doing the same thing, and so many of our really best students can find tuition costs because of automatic scholarships for their achievement, paying less than they would pay tuition here to
exactly.
go. Texas is another one that does that consistently. So we are having this happen to us, and we are getting a drain of our best economically, especially the best that don't have the money. So your poor best are being drawn to other places because they're making it financially possible for them to go to good institutions in other places. So we are becoming at a definite disadvantage if we don't. So I appreciate you bringing it forward.
Thank you.
Okay, before we go on, I know there are other questions, but Senator Morissette needs, you're on a timetable. No. And do, Representative Berger, do you have to head out?
I leave you at some point to hear the testimony about the Chemeketa program, so you have something right. that, you know, you can kind of start thinking about. I have to go next door to the Transportation Committee, but I do appreciate your attention to my idea and my...
Okay, thank you. And Representative Broome, you're going to be speaking to this. Are you on a time?
It's a different bill.
Okay, great. Okay.
I know I'm on no time rush.
Okay. So, Senator Morissette, do you mind us bringing... would you like to testify now on 2788?
I would like to testify
now. Or 2788. Okay, please. Thanks, Representative Berger. Okay, Senator, please.
You did open... Yes,
I opened both of those. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Senator... Let's just let the committee administrator sure. explain the bill, please.
Very briefly, excuse me, Vice Chairman Dambro, members of the committee, you have before you House Bill 2788. This modifies the calculation with respect to payment with regards to substitute teachers, and specifically deals with calculating when districts are, in fact, having a four-day work week as opposed to a five-day work week. In your pile this afternoon is an amendment that came in late yesterday that has been or has come in from LC, which further refines that calculation. Again, those are before your in your packets before you.
Thank you, Kevin. Senator.
Thank you very much. Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, which includes Springfield, Eugene, parts of Lane County. I am one of the chief co-sponsors, but I notice that a number of you are signed onto the bill as sponsors, and I have a special affinity in my heart for substitute teachers. I taught for almost 30 years in Springfield High School. I think this is an equity issue. I think substitutes deserve to be on the same proportional schedule that they deserve to be, and if you crowd the days together, a four-day week, it should be proportional.
Excuse me, Senator. Yeah. I think people in the back are having hard time hearing.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to repeat it. I'm sorry.
No, please don't. No.
Well, I will repeat it because that's all I'm going to say. I feel strongly that the substitute teachers, it's an equity issue, and I feel it's time. This bill has been here before. It has not passed. I feel strongly about it. I'm happy to see that there is a good support from members of this committee. I think there are at least four members of this committee that have signed on to it. So I urge you to give it serious consideration and pass it out of the committee with a due pass recommendation so we can deal with it on the Senate side. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anybody have any questions of Senator Morissette? Okay, thank you, Senator. Thanks for coming. Okay, let's go back to 2575 then, and we have some people who have signed up to speak. And I would ask Jim Ustrom and Kathy Campbell from Chemeketa to come up, please. And if you have a written testimony, you can give it to Debbie.
Just have a brochure.
That would be great. Thank you. And if you could please introduce yourselves and... Thank you.
I'm Kathy Campbell, and I'm the Associate Dean of Enrollment Services and Financial Aid at Chemeketa Community College.
And I'm Jim Ustrom. My current role is Dean of Students at Chemeketa, and that's where we started.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you.
Thank you. We, Representative Berger asked for us to come just give an overview of what we've done, and this is, I want to reiterate that we are in the first year of the program, so we just had the idea last year and have worked through a lot of kinks and brought it forward this year. And so basically, why did we create the program? A couple talking points there. At Chemeketa, we had a very low number of high school graduates in our district coming directly from high school to Chemeketa, so that was a targeted population, and we thought of a number of different initiatives that we could bring forward to bring that population directly to the high school, up to the college. We also had a very low number of high achieving, and we
defined that
as a 3.5 GPA coming from high school. And so we wanted to target that population, and it was just one of our student success initiatives. We developed the scholarship with the concept that any graduating high school senior in 2008 from a high school within our district would be eligible for it. They had to have a 3.5 cumulative grade point average at the end of the seventh semester so that we could actually accept them by January or February. So that's why we did that period. And then they had to enroll either in summer or fall immediately following their graduation from high school, because we knew from the research we did on continuing straight through into to college often creates a better persistence and retention rate for them. And then to maintain eligibility, it was a two-year scholarship. To maintain eligibility for the second year, they had to complete the first year with 36 credits and with a CUM GPA of 3.25. So that was the basic outline of it. The opportunities they received by applying for this and getting it were they'd receive a full tuition scholarship for up to two years. They'd get priority orientation, advising, and registration. For all other new students, it would have happened in August. For these students, it happened in May and June. So they also got a little bit of a kick onto the into the classrooms to enroll. Then we created a preview day activities for them. That was the Saturday before fall term, so they could come. We gave them tours, showed them where their classes were. There was a reception by President Roberts, our president, for the parents as well as the students. This population, the parents are extremely involved. It's a little bit different than many of our other student populations at Chemeketa, but this was so. We also provided some limited, we created 21 part-time jobs on campus, knowing that that was another key to having students succeed, so they didn't have to work outside the site of where they were going to school. And then we also encouraged this year and next year will be required participation in a community service project that we do at Chemeketa called Into the Streets. So those are some of the criteria of it. Do you want to go over the entering class?
So what we discovered, and we kind of went into this blind, we discovered that we had 324 applicants in the first year, for the current year, and 292 of those met that eligibility criteria of the 3.5 GPA, and 239 of those enrolled full-time. 107 of them were in lower division transfer programs, and 132 were in career technical education programs. We didn't limit them by major, so they could actually enroll in any program that they wanted. We did have recipients from every public high school in our district and some private high schools within our district. 67% were female, and 33% were male. 25% received a 4.0 GPA at the end of fall 2008, so 25% of the students, versus 9% of our other first-time freshmen. So it was a big increase in that success. 59% of the students received a 3.0 to 3.9 GPA versus 34% of all other first-time freshmen. So combined, 84% of this population received a 3.0 or higher GPA during that fall term. 98% persisted. You don't have these, and we're happy to give these to you, by the way.
That would be great.
Yeah, it might be helpful for you to have, so we'll get that to you. 98% of these students persisted to winter term versus 80% of other first-time freshmen. So it did make a difference in the retention, we believe. And then, you know, because it is our first year, and we've advertised again for next year, we have made some changes to our criteria based on what we've learned. And so the first year, we didn't accept homeschooled students into the program. But now we are accepting homeschooled students into the program. And what we have done is we have gone out and done some research from other colleges about what SAT scores and SAT scores
or ACT
would be equivalent to a 3.5. So for homeschooled students for the 09-10 year, they would have to have a combined reasoning test score of 1,200 for an SAT or an ACT composite score of 27. And those were the equivalents that other institutions were using. And then we also discovered last year that there were some students who were living in our district but attending high school out of our district, so we also included that population as we made the criteria for next year. So that application period recently closed, and we have 344 applicants for the 09-10 year, so that was a 6% increase for us, and 329 of those were eligible in terms of either residing or attending in the district and having the 3.5 or having those test scores. So that was a 12% increase for us for the second year.
I think the critical piece here for us is in September 2007, we had less than 40 students come directly from high school with a grade point average of 3.5 or above. And in September 2008, with this scholarship, obviously, we had the 239. And so that was obviously a huge increase. Also, the concept of them persisting, their persistence rate is so much higher than the other students. So that was one of the key pieces that we were looking for when we actually did piece together. We also have a universal fee or a fee for every credit that you take, which is $4, and now actually it's going to be $6 next year. But the students didn't receive that as part of their tuition, so they paid that. So that did generate some income. Also books, also the other costs of going to school sometimes. And what we also have found is that those students have brought other students with them. And when we did the initial orientation and we surveyed those students, over half of them had not planned to go to college. So it wasn't like they were necessarily all being taken from another institution, but they literally wouldn't have had access or had declared they wouldn't have had access to college. So that's the main piece that made us really see the benefit of it as we were going through, too. In all of our lives, you hear the personal stories of the students and their parents when what this means to them. So that was a resounding piece.
And I guess the last thing we'd share is it really does take a village sometimes to create success. And so what we did at Chemeketa was we really wanted to create something for these students because, you know, at a community college, you are a commuter campus, and it is very challenging, I think, to bring students on campus and have them feel a part of the community. So we actually created a team to manage the program, and that included Jim as the dean and staff from counseling and advising, from enrollment services, from admissions, from financial aid, from student life, business services, and information technology. And we absorbed the workload of having the students, but it really gave us a cohesive way. We met throughout the term on a regular basis, met with the students. Many of them took a new course that we developed called First Year Experience, so they actually had in their first term, they knew where tutoring was, where the library was, where counseling and advising was, and some other things. So all that probably plays a part, but we just want to share with you what we built and the success we think it brought.
I have one last point I'd like to make. When we were moving into this, the the rate of students coming into college in the community colleges was down compared to years past. We had capacity in the classroom. And so the initial concept of this is that they would be filling seats that were available in the classroom. We wouldn't have to have additional instructional costs because of this. Obviously, what happened dramatically across the state of Oregon is an increase in the number of students coming. We had an increase of 22% at Chemeketa, and it wasn't all scholars. It was from all over. And again, this continues. So there were some other things that did come to play. We did have to add some other sections, but not specifically for the scholars. But in our first blush, we looked at it from the perspective they would be filling seats that had been going empty.
Yes, thank you. I'm going to open it up for questions, but let me ask the first question, or just ask you to talk a little more about how this program is being funded,
sure.
where the funding is coming from.
The what we did was we isolated the fees that were coming in from this program, the $60,000, and we put that toward the jobs for the students. So that was one piece right there. We did not add new staff. We took that. There was a lot of work, and there continues to be a lot of work. But it was, as Kathy explained, it was split out among ongoing departments. So there wasn't really a staff increase, nor was there the funding piece on the from the fee that we used for other activities. What we did believe at beginning that would be that the bringing in this many students would generate more FTE, which would be part of the general fund that we would be getting. Obviously, it didn't come to play, but there are other things, the other materials and services and things of that sort that they do pay for that has helped offset. And we also believe it's probably doubled the number of students coming from the high schools to Chemeketa. So we also have a new soccer program, so there, you know, it's hard to track all the different pieces that mm-hmm. play into it. So the revenue from those students' tuition as well. So,
right. So, yeah.
But we did not budget additional revenue for the program. We just decided it was something that we thought was the right thing to do, and we really wanted to do it. We did want to keep our high-achieving students in our district and at our college, and so we just kind of said, we didn't put in any budget packages for it. We just said, this is the right thing to do, and we're going to do it.
And so your sense is that a significant proportion of these students wouldn't have gone to
right.
Chemeketa otherwise?
Mm-hmm. We did a survey for many things about first, if they were first generation, what their first interest was for a job, as well as if they would have gone on to had the other plans for college. And over half had said they did not believe they would have gone to college without this.
And we heard from many parents, yeah. of course, that said, oh, without this, they wouldn't have been able to go. So.
Okay. Well, I'll open it up for questions. Actually, before this panel came up, Representative Parker, you had a question, and Representative Springer. So let's start with Representative Parker.
It'll be very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I found the answer on the state legislative site here. Thank you.
Okay, great. Representative Springer.
Thank you. I'm not so brief, I guess. I didn't bring my computer, so. And this is really a question that might have been better answered by Representative Berger, but if you would take a stab at it, and you might have plenty of information. As I look at this, maintain the 3.5 the 3.5 GPA, which obviously I see the validity in that, and that's a good thing. And I'm thinking back 20 years ago when I went to college, and I got just under a 3.5, and I was working at least 20 hours a week because I was paying the bill as I went. And I was committing another 20 hours to my chosen profession, which was not this. And so I was doing pretty decent to get that GPA. Is there any allowance in the process for that? And that's not to open up the door, let's just lower standards. That's not the point. Those were very career-focused endeavors that I was doing, partnered with cooperative work experience credits with
right.
the college degree.
What we did was deliberately set that actually 3.25 that you had to maintain once you came
right.
there.
Right.
And so we encouraged all of them to be involved in the first year experience as well as providing tutoring, connecting them in with there's mandatory advising for this group, which doesn't happen for all the students on our campus. So we were watching them, and as each term we had a group of students in the student life area that connected with the students students throughout the term, also for that, the other pieces that happen for people, and just feeling part of the system and knowing how to work it, where to find tutoring, where to find writing center, things of that sort. So we did extra services to some degree, and we have expanded that to other student populations also. But so we've been monitoring them as from term to term to term. At the end of the term, when the grades came, we'd bring them back in. If, you know, so you didn't have to, we had people fall below 3 point from the end of fall term, and then we worked with them a lot in winter term so they would bring their grade point average up, because that's what we gave them the full year to recapture that grade point average and get those credits. I don't know if that answered, but that's a
thing. Well, I might just add that those students that were at risk, and of course we didn't keep 100% of them. I mean, we would be really honest with you about that. I think we lost maybe 10. We might have lost 10, like, in winter. We probably lost another 10 in spring. But that was a small number compared to the number that we got. And they weren't all for that reason. The minute we saw that they had dropped out, because students at Schmeckede can add and drop online. So, really, once you get them in, they can change their courses and do whatever. But with those at-risk students, when we saw the GPA in jeopardy, we did have an advisor work directly with those to say, well, let's try and pick different classes for you for winter term and try and work with them about how they could pick classes that they could be more successful in.
Follow up?
Please.
10 students or 10%?
10 students.
Okay.
And I don't know that for exact, but I know that we lost, I think maybe 7 fall or something.
Some of the dynamics are that we knew that they could start summer term. We had a number of students, and not many, less than 5, who actually just went for that one term for free in summer term and then moved on to a 4-year institution. So that was part of our numbers. And then we actually ended up with 330, we started with 239. By the end of fall term, we were down to 230, and we had 230 winter term. We don't know what we're going to have as spring.
Thank you.
So we actually lost a total of 9 students.
Representative Van Orman, did you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Dimbrough. Yes. First, I'd like to say that some of the exciting things we've heard about higher ed have come from the community colleges, and I'm very pleased to hear what you've had to say today. And one of the question I have is that if you're doing this voluntarily, why do we need to create a law to make other institutions do the same?
Well, I think... And we're sort of out here on an island. I think that the energy around the bill is that really no one had any idea what would happen when we created the program. And, of course, you know, our presidents meet, and not all of them were very happy about the fact that we created this program, to be quite honest with you. And so some of them saw it a little bit as a threat to, you know, the pressure that they might come to bear about, well, Schmeckede is doing it, why can't you do it? And so we kind of worked through all that. But we really have, I think, come full circle in terms of working with the presidents to say what a difference it has made. What a difference it has made in the number of students that we have. What a difference it has made for the energy in the classroom to have these students in with the students that we already have. And the other thing that we didn't mention on here, but I think was a very big aha for us, was it truly changed the way the high school counselors in our district looked at Schmeckede Community College. And so rather than being a last choice, we became a first choice from the high school counselors to say, why don't you take advantage of this program? And I think that in and of itself, as the success of the program kind of rolled out, to have it as a statewide program would mean that every school would be taking a part in it rather than Schmeckede decides they're going to do it. Well, maybe next year Lane will decide they're going to do it. Or maybe Clackamas will do it the year after that, because they're all kind of looking at how are we going to fund it and how are we going to do it. So I think the energy around it was to try, like Vicki said, to get something where you're targeting not only the need-based students but some of the scholar students and keeping them within the state.
One other piece is that we're a large institution with a large staff, and we are unlike Southwestern, or there are other schools that are so much smaller that don't have the staff resources to do it, I believe. And that's one of the pieces I think is really important. And so just the coordination of it is a rather large piece. So I think that was another piece that Vicki had, was trying to get it to some of the institutions that might not be able to pull it off.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chairman Denbrough. My concern is this is a bill for all higher ed. And do you see the concern that if all of a sudden it gets offered and I can take that and get my tuition waiver from a four-year school, and a lot of these are 3.5 students would say, Chemeketa, U of O, Oregon State, Eastern, that you would in fact lose out to those students that you were getting now because they could take their tuition and go to a four-year school?
I think we would lose some, but I also think for many students, they want their parents or they want to live at home.
Okay.
And so I think that's another piece that affords your community college throughout the state, that most students have the opportunity to live at home while they're doing that, more so than if you were going to Corvallis or Eugene or Portland or whatever.
And I guess I would also say it mostly people choose because of the fit. I mean, yes, they choose because of the money, but they also choose because of the fit. And so some of these students would rather be in a classroom that has 24 students in it than have 200 students in it or 600 students in it. So the class size is an issue, and the fact that, you know, they really do talk to their own instructors is... Michael, you know. And so you don't just get to a TA, you actually get to the instructor. And so I think those choices are made really for many reasons. But personally, I don't care where they go as long as they go.
We also have all the community colleges have dual enrollment programs with different four-year institutions. So part of our program for the second year is introducing the scholars onto the transfer process and how we can get them dual enrolled in both schools and move them on if they want to continue.
Any other questions? Representative Springer, please.
Thank you. I guess one last question, and I hope it's not too big of a question, but you're in your second year.
End of our first year.
Okay, going into your second year. And you've made a few changes that really make sense. Looking at what you've learned this last year, maybe the changes that you haven't instituted yet that you want to, what are those? Because those could be the big ones out here that we need to really be looking at today.
Yeah, we have some ideas about that, actually.
I bet you do.
Well, one of our discoveries is that a 3.5 GPA is not necessarily equal throughout the land. And so we had some idea about maybe in the future combining that with some placement test scores so that we were really making sure that students were ready in writing and reading and, college-ready students, because we are discovering that there were some people in the population that need a little more help than others.
That's the main.
That's really the biggest one.
May I follow up, Mr.
Please.
Chair? So in those cases, the students that are coming and they're not ready for, what was it, Math 100 or something like that, that level, the scholarship also takes care of those remedial classes to get them there?
I would say for all students but one, and one student didn't have English language competency, and had gotten a 3.5 with a bilingual, so what we did is we basically held that scholarship, and we worked with her through the ESL program, and she had a year to gain language competency, and so she's working on it, and so then she could start with this next year. But everyone else, basically, yes, we did work with, and we advised them into the developmental courses and worked with them on how they could move
forward. Okay, Representative Roblin, I think this will have to be the last question.
Yeah, it'll just be a quick one. Okay. Have you had much experience with the alternative of getting in the 27 and the 1200, the ACT and the other score that you set up for your homeschooling? Is that an option for a student that maybe had a 3.2 in high school but did well on the test? I mean, do you give that option both ways, or is it one or the other?
It is something that's been brought forward that we might do next year.
Okay.
So this year, we were trying to implement it first, and we were really strict about the 3.5. Then we opened it up to homeschool because we realized that was a population we really wanted to serve, although we should be serving also. And so then we were moving on that. So that's where we first found about the SAT and the ACT scores. Now, so the question comes in, should there be a combination of that? We tried to be as simple as possible to start, and now we're looking at a little more complex, still keeping it easy for people to understand and apply.
Okay, well, thank you, Kathy and Jim, for talking to us about the programs. And we have another person who wants to speak about it, but this is a real multitasking committee today. We already have two bills that are open. I'm actually going to open a third so that Representative Bruin can come in.
And we will write up this testimony, make sure you get it so you have it.
Thank you. Great. Okay, I'd like to open a hearing, a public hearing, on House Bill 2851. And Representative Bruin is going to speak to us about it, but first, Kevin, if you could just introduce this bill. And let me just say, public, I'm doing this because in a few minutes the Speaker is going to come in to speak about yet another bill. So we're really going to be juggling a lot of balls. Thank you.
Members of the committee, the three-ring circus continues. Before you is House Bill 2851 that will create a task force on alternative tuition systems, requires members of the task force to have knowledge and experience in the field of higher education. It does require the task force to submit a report to the interim committee on the legislature dealing with higher education, as well as has a sunset provision at the next session. It does declare an emergency with respect to this matter.
Thank you, Kevin. Representative Bruin.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair, and thanks for fitting me in. For the record, my name is Scott Bruin. I represent House District 37, and this is based on an idea that your chair, Representative Gelser, and I have been noodling with a little bit. It talks about alternative tuition, and the first question that some folks have asked me, what in the world are you talking about with alternative tuition? You know, one person asked me, are you talking about doing it in barter or rubles? And no, that's not what this would do. At least that's not the intent of this legislator. Before I sort of get into the detail of what it's trying to get at, let's just lay down some parameters. One is something that I know we all agree with, but the recognition that college costs have risen far faster than general inflation. It's hard for a student, regardless of how they're paying, whether it's they're paying through work, whether they're paying tuition through loans, the grants, or even if it's subsidized by mom and dad, it's becoming much more expensive, far exceeding the rate of general inflation. In fact, higher education looks much more like healthcare than it does any other sort of component in society. It's also a recognition as a groundwork that loans, sort of the standard ways of paying for college outside of just having the money to begin with, maybe through parents, it's recognition that loans are problematic because they are inflexible and often resulting in damaging and long-time burdens to students, especially when they graduate and first hit the job market. At that point, their debt load is the highest, and more than likely, their income potential is at its lowest that it will be in their intent. So it's a complete inverse relationship with the need to pay and the ability to pay. It's also recognition that grants are problematic. We love grants. We as legislators, as public officials, all I'm sure support the Student Opportunity Grant in Oregon, other grant vehicles, whether it's in the state or nationally. The problem is this is a finite resource, and this session more than any that we've ever served in, we're realizing how finite a resource that is when we're trying to do the right thing for students through the opportunity grants, yet we're facing an unprecedented budget shortfall. So, is there an alternative out there? And today I'd advocate that there is. There's at least the germ of an idea to start talking about it. Instead of looking at debt, student debt, as something else to look at besides just grants, which are a finite resource, let's look at equity. Let's develop the idea to allow a student to basically, and pick an institution so it's more tangible. I'm a Duck graduate, so pick the U of O. Allow a student like me, a young 18 or 19-year-old Scott Bruin, to enter into a contract with the University of Oregon that says for 4 years to get my bachelor's degree, whatever that may be in, I get a free ride. I get, in effect, a tuition-free 4 years. Then the contract says that over the next 30 years, maybe it's 40 years, maybe it's until the day I die, I will pay, and here's the part we have to have a task force to put together, but I will pay 1, 2, 3, 4% of my gross income will just be written in my check or be automatically taken out of my pay and to go to the U of O. The idea here, as you could well imagine, is that if I'm a teacher and making, say, $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year, it would be 1 or 2% or 3%, whatever the number is, over my career to the U of O out of my gross income. If I'm a stockbroker and making millions of dollars a year, it would be the same 1, 2, or 3% regardless. So in some situations, you'll get a situation where a student may not pay the full amount of their tuition over time, or may just become closer just a little bit more. In other situations, you could envision, depending on what that student does for a living, paying far more, 10 or 20-fold times more than what they actually got in tuition. The benefit of this is it's flexibility. If it's a small amount of money, regardless of how much you make, if it's a small amount of money, it's never going to be a burden, at least the same kind of burden that debt will be on a student. Also, if you're in a situation where you're unemployed, as far as I know, you do not get student loan debt relief if 10 years from now you lose your job or 5 years from now you lose your job. So once again, it's a recognition that, it's asking the question, is there a better way, an alternative way to look at funding tuition? This has been tried in the East. It's still in its fledgling stages, so it's not a unique idea to Oregon. There's no real reason that it has to be done publicly. The U of O or Oregon State or Portland State or OHSU or a community college, it could be done privately. The difference privately is that there'll be a larger profit motive with a private entity. I'm not against that, but there'd be a larger profit motive, and probably the motivation of the student would be less for writing that, if you will, that contract with a private entity than it would with the U of O. The idea with, once again, my example with the U of O is maybe my contract calls for me to pay 3% of my gross income to U of O over 20 years. I get used to writing a check to U of O every single month. Probably at the end of that 20 years, I'm still going to keep writing those checks. Be true to your school, and that's exactly what we're trying to get at here. I think that method, whether it's done through the schools or done privately, there's still a much tighter bond. There's always going to be a tighter bond between me, you and your institution of higher learning than there will be between you and Acme Student Loan Company. That's never going to be a fun relationship, whereas your desire to pay your school, even well and beyond your tuition, I think there's a motivation there. So that's what this task force is tasked to look with. It doesn't say that in the bill because it was a sort of a last-minute drop and you just had to get the bill out, but that's certainly the legislative intent from this end is to say, hey, universities, hey, governor, put together a task force and look at this model. And is there a model here that works? And nobody's talking about not collecting money. In fact, the goal here is a win-win, is maybe to collect more money for the institutions than they otherwise would, as well as make a long, lifelong devotee of the alumni. So that was a lot. Any questions?
Thanks, Representative. Representative Harker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Maybe a question to you first. Do we have people from the universities coming to present on this subject today?
No, I don't believe so, unless any of them would like to come forward.
Can I address that? I had,
of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes. Rep. Harker. I had a representative from the Oregon University system come to me and talk to me about it, and basically was the question, what do you mean by alternative tuition? Because there's nothing in this bill that gets at the equity component that I'm talking about. So we had a discussion, and as far as I could tell, she was interested in it, and once again, this bill or the recommendations the task force would produce aren't certainly not my mindset to come out with some sort of a mandate. Mm. It's just that, hey, given the challenges we have, given the challenges, even in the best of times, given the challenges that we have with grants and student loans, the challenges that might put a student into a career path that student may not absolutely want, frankly, but they're looking at student loans. Med school is a great example of this. We find that many people go into specialties rather than general practice because the debt's about the same, but obviously the payback is much different. And this would allow, in a situation like that, would allow somebody to go into a GP profession, probably making less than the eye surgeon, but still paying an equal amount of their income to repay it, as far as a contract is concerned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I know it's just a task force, but I wondered if they had come in and weighed in heavily against it, because one aspect of this that I think would occur, depending upon how many people were to take us up on this, mm-hmm. if we were to make it available, would be short-term cash flow problems.
Yeah, there's a bridge that has to be crossed at the beginning. Now, you would assume once a program had been going for,
right,
name your amount of years, 10 years.
Something greater than 10,
It more than pays for itself because you have the cash flow. But like anything, when you're starting from zero, you have to get out of the ground. That that's a recommendation that I hope the task, I don't have the answer to that. I mean, I could come up with, you know, some sort of private-public partnership. You can come up with a whole bunch of things. Even a temporary loan from general fund payback, some, I don't know. But hopefully that's the idea of the task force, hopefully some certified smart people to say, well, here's the way you do that when you have those, the first 5 or 10 years where the demand exceeds the cash flow. But this is not intended to be, once again, this is not intended to be a grant. It's not intended to be a giveaway. In fact, net-net, it's intended to collect more.
Okay, any other questions for Representative Bruin?
No, I...
Yes, Representative Mallon.
I just want to thank Representative Bruin or Representative Gelser. We're talking about your alternative...
Me.
Yes. alternative tuition, and I had all sorts of envision, like plowshares,
rubles,
yeah,
chickens, cattle.
Now, actually, we had talked about this sometime before. This is neat stuff. I mean, we're talking 529 plans about prepaid tuition, which is not a new idea, but it'd be new to Oregon. So you can pay for college before you go, when you're there, maybe after. And this is neat stuff. We need to do it.
Thank you for that comment.
I think it creates a stronger bond between student and institution than we currently have. It creates a long-term loyalty. We all have long-term loyalties, but sort of puts that, you know, puts some dollar signs behind that long-term loyalty to the benefit of both. Great. Well, I appreciate your consideration and hopeful. I'm very hopeful that the committee will take the next step with this bill, which is a work session.
Thank you very much, Rick Bruin.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to speak to House Bill 2851? Seeing not, it is with great pleasure that I close one of these public hearings. I'm going to close the public hearing on 2851.
Okay.
And it's my pleasure to see that our committee chair has returned, and she looks fairly intact. I'm happy to see her. And so we'll pass the gavel back to where it belongs. And the next thing, we had someone signed up for
speaker.
Oh, yeah, speaker. Yeah.
And so are we already open on that one?
No.
Okay. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2011 and invite Speaker Dave Hunt. Kevin, do you want to give a quick summary?
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. I'll give the briefest of summaries. Essentially, this is a bill that would allow those 65 years of age or older to audit without fees an unlimited number of courses at institutions of higher education, specifically the state institutions with the State Board of Higher Education as well as the community colleges. And this would first come into effect during the 2010-2011 school year.
Welcome, Mr. Speaker. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Representative Dave Hunt. I think this bill is really an attempt to do one of the rare things we are going to be able to do to actually increase services for Oregon seniors. I think we've got a rare opportunity here to really expand what some individual campuses and some, both on the university side and the community college side, have already taken the initiative to do themselves and expand that opportunity statewide in statute. I think we all recognize that the benefits of lifelong learning really can serve these seniors well, but also by giving them an opportunity to audit these courses, they can really take that back to serve as a benefit in our communities as well. These are really an opportunity for them to continue in an active lifestyle, continuing to claim that lifelong learning model that I think so many of us really affirm. This is, as I said, this is already in practice on some campuses, but House Bill 2011 would codify it in statute, so they really do have a consistent opportunity statewide in all university campuses and all community college campuses. Both OUS and OCCA have come forward with some suggested amendments, particularly around, if you look in line 5 of the bill, particularly looking at the definition of courses to make sure, for instance, that it doesn't include community ed courses, which they already provide, which are utilized by many seniors and many other members of communities, and are a revenue stream currently for those folks. But really are focused on courses that we may come back with, for instance, language that focuses on courses that are specifically working toward a degree, not community ed courses. We might go to another term besides courses, because we don't obviously want to take away any income they're currently getting. But utilize a situation where they've already got a course, they're already paying an instructor, they've got available seats in those classrooms. And Representative Dembrough's courses, I'm sure, never have open seats, but some instructors occasionally have courses that have open seats. And where there is space available, as line 7 says, and where the instructor approves, as line 8 says, that we've got an opportunity for these seniors to be able to take advantage of that without cost to them. And I think with some tweaks to the bill, we can make sure that it's done without cost to the universities or the community colleges as well. So I know there are some folks behind me that would like to testify in support of this, and would welcome your questions.
Thank you. Any questions for the speaker on this bill?
Sure.
Representative Roland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Why so young?
Why so young? We'll have some age balance among the other people testifying in support of this bill. Just as I see, Madam Chair, Representative Roland, there is age balance between the
That's
two
very
of you.
Thank you. Representative Dembrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Speaker Hunt, I want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. It, you know, when I look back to when I started teaching, which was probably 65 years ago, it was a while ago, and back then seniors could attend classes and could actually at that time get credit for classes at no cost. Yeah. And we had a lot of seniors on the campus, and it made the campus a much more exciting and interesting place, as well as obviously added value to their lives. Mm-hmm. And I would say that of those students, probably 95% at least had no interest in credit. They really just wanted what would be analogous to an auditing situation. So I think this is a great thing. I think it's great for Oregon, and it's going to be a really good thing for the campuses.
Thank you. I agree.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? Thank you very much for bringing the bill and taking time to come visit us.
You bet.
So next we'll have Fred Sedwick?
Swooch.
Swooch. Schwa. Schwa. Fred Schwa, John, and Lisa Pinheiro, please. Welcome to the committee, and if you would please start your testimony by stating your name for the record. It would be
My name is Fred Schwach. I live in Newburgh. And a couple of years I taught at Mount Hood Community College. I was teaching product development and primarily a drafting course. And it would have been real nice to have a couple of old machinists there to tell these kids why you can't hold those ridiculous tolerances. It would have really been very helpful. And what I was really looking for was a way to get the generations to talk to each other. And I'm currently volunteering out at the Air Museum in McMinnville. And there's some stories out there that really those people should be brought to classes and tell what happened so these kids know what it cost for them to be able to stand on a street corner and protest. One old fellow out there, he flew 30 missions over Germany in a B-17. And he's got some real good stories to tell. And it's remarkable to me that as we go along, we seem to forget what predecessors have sacrificed to get what the kids have today. And I would hope that instructors would look at these people as a teaching resource rather than a burden. And I'm afraid that some of them are going to say, well, heck, the class is already too big, to heck with it. Well, just let us in to listen, if nothing else. But I think that we could be a valuable resource as far as helping people today understand what went on before. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Lisa Panero with the Oregon University System. I'm here today to say that this bill is a great idea. As the speaker has indicated, however, many of our, if not all of our university campuses already offer this. It is in our fee policy now. So we will continue to work with the speaker and his staff to kind of finesse some of the things that we do have concerns with, just to make sure we have some flexibility if in the event that we have some capacity issues, to make sure that other senior citizens that want to take advantage of this benefit have the proper guidance to get through the process of registration, to clarify what fees can be waived and what really we could not waive. So I look forward to that opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Parker.
Beach.
Barely.
Youth. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you said that we can already do this. So why do we need a law to do what's already possible? That's a little bit rhetorical question for right now. But the fees that you're considering are things like lab fees associated with chemistry, et cetera, I would think.
Madam Chair, members, that's correct. Material fees, lab fees.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, good. So you'll try to figure all of that out?
We will.
Yes, okay. And then to your former presenter there, I think I hear you in terms of the stratification in this country that goes on by age, you know, getting cross-generational conversation going would be a very good thing, and it might even go a ways towards erasing what...
And you see, one advantage of being around youngsters is I've noticed they move the floor further away every time I drop something, and maybe they'll pick it up for me, see?
Okay, thanks.
Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, sir, your lapel pin, can you, because I have good eyes, but not that good.
Well, they're my water wings. I'm a submarine sailor. So that, I tell everybody that I was a coward and wanted to stay out of sight. And I'm out of sight.
Thank you for your service.
I don't think so.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Representative Dimbrough?
This is not a question, just in response to Representative Harker. Actually, I wasn't aware that auditing is, that seniors can audit at no cost at OUS schools, but I know it, certainly at my community college, they do pay a fee. There's auditing. I think people who audit pay the same tuition as people who are taking it for credit, and I assume that's true of other colleges as well.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Mr. Schwab. From Newburgh, my district. Are you promising to not bully the other students when you go in and talk to them?
Well, I don't know. That depends on what day of the week it is.
Watch out for him.
Do you promise not to take any cookies or Diet Coke with you when you go in?
No, I'm not. I swore off Diet Coke a long time ago.
Right. Thank you both very much. And next we have John Wyckoff and Dana Haynes.
That's great.
Thank you both for coming.
Thank
Welcome.
You. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Community College Association, here to speak briefly about House Bill 2011. I think the speaker did a pretty good job of covering our feelings about this issue, and I think one of the things we really appreciate about this bill is that it really highlights the role that community colleges play in our communities, that we see our role and the colleges see their role as serving the entire community, all aspects of the community. It's not just the 18-year-old who just got out of high school and is going to college for the first time. It's not even just the mill worker who was laid off and is going back for the skills he needs to get, or he or she needs to get back into the workforce. We really are serving people at all aspects of life, and that's becoming it's always been, but it's a critically important thing to do for any number of reasons. As the speaker pointed out, several of our colleges do this on some level, have discounted tuition and other programs. Many of the colleges work directly with senior centers to provide programming in senior centers. So this is something that we believe in and are committed to. Having said that, I think it is worth noting that before the last recession, we offered more of these programs. We were able to offer sort of a broader portfolio of these sorts of things, and there were cutbacks to these sorts of programs in the recession during 2002 to 2003. But I think that that this bill has made a very good attempt to allow for discretion at the local level to not have it be a cost issue. As the representative from OUS said, we also we want to refine some of that language a bit to ensure that we have the ability to make those decisions where we need to and feel very comfortable about and very good about the process of working through that with the speaker. It's been a very good process so far, and we look forward to continuing it. Just want to touch very briefly on sort of where some of those issues are, and he did touch on some of them. The community ed classes, we don't get reimbursed by the state for those. That is one area that would be a difficulty. We also want to be able to make those decisions where Central Oregon Community College, for example, has actually had to shut off enrollment. This is not an enrollment cap due to cost. This is a capacity issue. They've had record enrollment this year. They are national leaders in this area right now and are literally at capacity. There just are not seats. But in its current form, we there is ability to make those determinations, and we just want to work to refine that a bit. Another area would be in our career technical programs. If you have an extra seat, say, in a Spanish class, or an extra few seats, it probably isn't an issue to put another person in a seat and who's going to add to the class and be a great asset to it. Now, if you're talking about a welding class or a diesel mechanic class, I mean, the issue isn't just simply having a space. There are materials and other costs that go into it, so we would want to make sure that we can address those, because that's an area where just simply having the space is not the cost issue. But again, as I say, we feel very comfortable with the direction that this is going, and that we will be able to refine this and make this work as intended and do the good things that it is supposed to do. And with that, I will conclude and take any questions.
Thank you. Dana.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dana Haynes. I am the Public Affairs Manager for Portland Community College. And for the record, this is the first time I've ever testified before a committee of this legislature, so this is a big day for me. I used to cover this legislature. I've spoken to it. I want to speak very briefly on a couple of issues and accent on the word briefly. One is that at Portland Community College, we offer half fee for people who are 62 and older, and if they can't meet that half fee, we waive it, and we do that fairly regularly. It's part of my boss, Dr. Preston Pulliam's philosophy of access for all. I mean, he says that, but he really means it. And so if seniors want to take a class and they don't have the ability to take the class, we find a way to make it happen anyway. I want to talk briefly about a program called Life by Design Northwest that we're really very excited about, very proud of. It's what it does is it's for people who are 50 and older. It helps the retirees who are find a path for a new career for themselves. It involves some life planning, some lifelong learning, and opportunities to engage with civic organizations. We take these seniors and we help them discover a passion in their life, design a plan to achieve a goal around that passion, and then we engage them with nonprofits. Our partners include the Morrison Child and Family Services, Oregon Public Broadcasting, Portland State University, AARP, Multnomah County Library, so it's a very vast organizations put this together. Currently have hundreds of seniors that are taking advantage of this program. And basically, it gives them the tools to identify some goals, activities to provide some fulfillment, and an entryway to participation in high-impact paid or volunteer opportunities at certified nonprofits. And these nonprofits cover the gamut in the Portland area. Beyond that, we also have some other programs and classes like conversation classes, book sharing programs, resume writing classes. Some of these folks maybe haven't written a resume in 40 years. We have an interesting class quite recently on how to care for your aging parent, because remember, this is the first generation of retirees taking care of a generation of retirees. So that's some extra challenges. And finally, it's done so well that we got a $25,000 grant from the Oregon Community Foundation to create the Life by Design Initiative and to take this program across the state and eventually replicate it across the nation. One final thought is, during this recession, this is an unprecedented opportunity for our most innovative and community-minded organizations to tap into these senior citizens, their energy, their intelligence, their brains, and their experience. And it's a perfect link for those two things. And finally, a lot of these folks who are retirees are watching their 401ks evaporate. This is an opportunity to get them into a pipeline for a second or third paying career. And with that, I'd be glad to take questions.
Thank you both very much. Are there questions for this panel? No, seeing that. Oh, Representative Edelman,
you know, I just resemble the remarks.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you very much.
Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on House Bill 2011? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2011. And we're still in public hearing on 2575. Mm-hmm. Carrie Hendricks, please. Karen.
Carrie.
Hi. Hello, welcome to the Education Committee.
Thank you very much. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Carrie Herrings. I am a board member of the Oregon Students of Color Coalition, which is an affiliate board of the Oregon Student Association, an organization that represents 100,000 statewide students within post-secondary education. I'm also a student at the University of Oregon. I'm here today to ultimately oppose, on behalf of the organization, House Bill 2575. Students believe that this does not, or this actually exacerbates existing inequities within the education system. And while a 3.5 GPA is certainly something that is desirable among students, we do not believe that it is something that is attainable by all students. Frankly, it does not take into consideration the time of, or actually take into consideration who exactly and what constituencies and what communities have access to this GPA. And I'll explain that for the reasons along the lines of time in terms of like students who within these certain demographics and time as well as different students who need to put in time to, for example, working during school to support their family. For example, I personally grew up in Forest Grove School District, where 37% of the school district is Latino, 47% are on free or reduced lunch. While I was tracked towards a path that allowed me to participate in honors courses and advanced placement courses, I noticed that not all of my peers were represented in those spaces. On the lines of low-income students, students of color, and rural students, all students at the margins of the educational attainment gap. And this level of success comes less often and with more effort than for students who have the best educational resources prior to high school and graduation and who face fewer obstacles. If you have a copy of the handout that I gave you, there is a study on the back, or on the second sheet, that explains in graphs and numbers what I am talking about. And the study was done by the Civil Rights Project out of Harvard University, where they actually analyzed merit-based aid and whom it actually targets. In the second graph, you can see that while 60% of white students who were a part of, or excuse me, were public high school graduates. 75% of these students were the ones who were actually receiving the aid. Now, the intentions were to directly target the students from those underrepresented communities or those who would be disenfranchised and most vulnerable from actually accessing post-secondary education. But in comparison to other some of the other minority groups within the graph, for example, while 16% of the Hispanic students were graduates, only 10% of them were receiving the aid. This doesn't mean that there is never room for merit-based aid in Oregon, but we are barely half funding the Oregon Opportunity Grant as is. Right now, there are currently 7,000 students who have applied after the December 1st cutoff date, almost three-quarters of which are earning less than $20,000 per year. As of this week, more than 80% of these students on the wait list are independent students. Oregon is light years away from a time when there will be revenue to sustain the Oregon Opportunity Grant. With all this in mind, the Oregon Students Association believe that fully funding the Oregon Opportunity Grant would do much of what the Oregon Scholars Program aims to do, in that it would make college affordable for all Oregonians, including middle-income Oregonians, and gives incentives to those who might not be able to make the honor roll. Need-based aid should always and continue to be the priority for Oregon.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Maurer.
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. So would you be supportive if the opportunity grant was fully funded, then we can do merit-based scholarships? Or is it you have you can have a fixed percentage based on funding? I mean, to me, there absolutely, you have to have merit-based scholarships. I mean, if we want a high level workforce, there has to be room for merit-based scholarships,
mm-hmm.
Along with the grant, clearly. But I don't see fully funding the opportunity grant as a threshold before you start a merit-based program. Comments?
Chair Gelster, members of the committee, as well as Representative Maurer. The Oregon Student Association stance would be we are here to advocate the accessibility for post-secondary education of all students. We take particular consideration in recognizing those who currently or who have historically not had that access. We are not here to necessarily disagree or nitpick with merit-based aid, but we just believe that it does not fully ensure that all students are attaining post-secondary education, specifically underrepresented, like minority groups based on either rural or location, low income, or students of color. So ultimately, to kind of level the playing field, we believe that need-based aid, like the Oregon Opportunity Grant, would be the best option and the best opportunity to ensure that access to post-secondary education is achieved by all students within the state.
Follow-up?
Because my problem when we use the term need-based is that there's this middle window of people who don't qualify for need-based but are not, I mean, you know, not upper middle class. And so essentially I'll use the term working poor, for lack of a better term, that kind of fall between the crack. And so their window is only open for merit-based. And so I totally understand where you're coming from, but I also think that there has to be a place for a merit-based system.
Absolutely, Representative Maurer. Certainly, I want to point out that need-based aid does not disregard students who fall within the crack. I guess students or families who are along the lines of middle income or have like a middle income level. by supporting the Oregon Opportunity Grant, though I don't think that those specific constituency of students would be ignored, rather supported as well. Currently, I fall right in the middle of that. I have not received, this is my fifth year of school, never have received the Oregon Opportunity Grant.
So you see the problem, or you see that?
Absolutely. But I don't believe that merit-based aid would be the best avenue to support that for the simple fact of it not taking into a consideration or not accounting for some of our most vulnerable communities.
Thank you.
Representative Dimbro.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Carrie, thanks for your testimony. If the opportunity grant were, you know, under the shared responsibility model, were fully funded, would you be receiving some aid through it?
Can you repeat the question? I'm sorry.
Yeah, if you know, right now we're not fully funding the opportunity grant, and is that part of the reason why you're not haven't been receiving any aid? That is, if it were fully funded, is your sense that you would be?
There's a chance that I may, but I feel just based on the pattern as to how financial aid has been awarded in the past that it may, I still may not qualify personally. But.
Yeah. Well, let me just say that, you know, I think the intent of the shared responsibility model of the opportunity grant is to fund middle class children from middle class families, and I want to say that I am a co-signer of House Bill 2575, which set up the Scholars Program. My understanding was, you know, in doing so, was that it would be funded after the Opportunity Grant was fully funded. So I think what you're saying is certainly, you know, consistent with my goals for this. Another concern that I have, you know, is with the students, you know, who are many of my own students, actually, are people who've been out of school for a couple of years. I mean, I think that the Scholars Program and the Shemeketa Scholars Program, as an example, is does a great job of motivating high school kids, frankly, you know, to stay in school and to stay on a glide path to higher education. But not all students are going to fit into that mold, and a number of them are very very good students potentially, and we need support systems for those students as well.
Great, thank you. Thank you very much. Yes. Is there anyone else that wants to be heard on House Bill 2575? Please. Thank you, Carrie.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you. For the record, I'm Gary Ann Dean. I'm the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association, representing all 20 of the nonprofit colleges in the state. I wanted to just make a couple of comments that sort of bubbled up as you were talking. First of all, I think it's worth noting that the state is not a vacuum for scholarships. We have hundreds of millions of dollars of scholarship money in the state, virtually going to students at every public and private two-year and four-year school. So it's not like we have to start something that doesn't already exist. The Oregon Student Assistance Commission manages hundreds of those scholarships already, which is a very unique state program across the country, that they would have a state agency managing so many private scholarships. So that's already going on out there. One other fact I think we should throw into the conversation, Oregon is a net importer of college students. We do attract bright students from across the country, more so than we lose them. So I just wanted to throw those extra facts on the table. Madam Chair, Representative Dimbro, to your question about if the opportunity grant were fully funded, that would be a wonderful if to imagine. We'll be lucky if we get it halfway funded by the end of this session. If it were fully funded, I think you would find an awful lot of people in this room very happy to talk about merit-based aid on top of that. We used to have a very small merit-based program called the Cash Award Program that sat on top of the opportunity grant for those students who had a slightly higher GPA and already qualified for a need-based grant. They would get a little extra reward as they went off to college. That would be one way to tackle this, but I think everybody who works for Access is really focused right now in Oregon on making sure we get the opportunity grant finally funded the way it should be. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Van Orman.
I have, as you speak, it suddenly, this question comes across my mind, is that, yes, I think that we need to focus on our best and brightest in our state, but in many ways, this is a national issue. Is that a correct assumption, that it should be the nation that's talking about educating our best and brightest?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, it's an issue for all of us at every level. It's an issue for the local Rotary Club, who puts up scholarships. It's an issue for every college and university president in this state and every state. It's an issue for every governor, for every legislator. Obviously, getting our best and brightest into school is critical to the nation's future.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2575. I'm going to briefly open a work session on House Bill 2518. Colleagues, this was the bill that had to do with fixing the ethics law so that students could go on trips that were chaperoned by their teachers. As you know, the ethics things have fallen in the committee of our good rules chair, Representative Roebland, and this would be a good time for us to simply move this bill unamended to the rules committee so that it can be dealt with in the larger context of ethics reform. So I would take a motion on that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Roebland, is it your desire to have this unamended or with the dash one?
I think unamended is fine. There's a bunch of other amendments that are actually following with it. So we can take all of them down there and look, because I think there's a number of them that are being considered, and we can do that. And I do appreciate it. We really wanted to see, is this just this particular piece of legislation and this idea something that this policy group thinks we should be including in the bigger issue of ethics, because that's why it came to education. I mean, it really was, we are the group that should be looking at educational policy, and this is strictly an educational policy. Should this exemption exist for teachers with respect to that? There may be some others in some of the other amendments that go a little farther than just education. Some of them are education, but my issue is, you know, is this something that this group believes we should pursue in our looking at the ethics? Yeah. So to me, sending them all down and saying, yeah, we think that would be appropriate. If this group decided they didn't want to pass this bill, it would be saying to the Rules Committee, don't consider this part of the overall thing. So,
yeah. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that issue, I'm committed enough to this going through that I would be a little bit apprehensive if you think that any of those amendments or expansions
That's
to
what I wanted to hear
other
too.
Areas
Thank you.
Might decrease its likelihood of
Thank you.
Passage.
I appreciate hearing that, too. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Representative Dimbrough?
We talked about, you know, one of the amendments we talked about would expand this to college faculty, and that's one that will be amended
That is clearly the same issue. There have been a couple others that have been added since then, other amendments that aren't quite as clearly that way, but we'll look at all of them.
This bill has two things that make it unique. The first is that it has a subsequent referral to rules. So anything we do here will be reworked in rules. The second is that it has a relating clause, which I believe is relating to ethics. And as a result, it has many people that would like to be related to it. And the number of requests for amendment we have received have been many. And Representative Roebland and the Rules Committee, they love to look at all of those kinds of amendments, and it seemed unfair to keep from them the opportunity to wrestle with all of them. And because this committee is about being fair and giving Representative Roebland, making him happy, that's what I would suggest that we do.
I'm all for it.
Well, Madam Chair,
I will keep that clear, and we may keep it separate just for that reason.
I'm sure that the chair of the Rules Committee will dispose of these amendments correctly, and so
particularly because he is also the sponsor of the bill.
Yeah. And so knowing that, Madam Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2518 to the Rules Committee, that we refer it to the Rules Committee.
So Representative Dimbro moves that we move House Bill 2518 to the Rules Committee by prior reference. Is there further discussion, Representative Harker?
The only, I think I am increasingly confident that this will be, my concerns will be taken into account here. I mean, perhaps it's coincidental that we have the president of the OICA here today, but this is really critical to those folks
in
terms of placement of their students out for student teaching, et cetera.
Yes.
Yes?
Yes, it is.
I believe I'm comfortable then. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Is there any objection to the motion? Seeing none, the motion passes, and House Bill 2518 is on its way to rules. I will close the work session on House Bill 2518, and we are still in public hearing on House Bill 2788. Thank you for your patience. And we would call up Phyllis Kirkwood, Phyllis Ramey, Sally Sue Ehlers. And I would ask, let's work to keep this panel to about 10 minutes because we have other folks also that want to testify on the bill. Welcome.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Gelsner and members of the committee, I'm Phyllis Kirkwood, Oregon Substitute Teachers Association. I live in Beaverton. And we really thank you for holding the hearing today because it's our vacation and we didn't have to take time off from work in order to come. And several of our colleagues are here in the hearing room, and I'd like them to stand now. Our substitute teachers.
Welcome to the Capitol. Thank you for coming.
Support our bill. Chair Gelser and members of the committee, our bill deals with what happens to the substitute teacher's salary when the school district goes to a four-day week. And we're all of the districts have to have the same amount of instruction time. So the instruction time is divided up and put on the other 4 days, and there is no difference. As we discovered in our research, all of the districts pride themselves on keeping the same amount of instruction. Therefore, if a fourth of the instruction is taken from the Friday and placed on each of the other 4 days, then we multiply our daily minimum salary by 1.25. And in the amendment that you just received, we were encouraged to also include the 1.25 in our salary, which we have after 10 days for the long-term substitute. That salary would also increase by 1.25. And then instead of after 10 days to get to the long-term salary, it would be 8 days because that is the same as 2 weeks. So that is basically what our bill is. You might ask, have the substitute teachers complained? Not really, because when you're an on-call teacher, you want to go and be there and supply the education that's needed. So they won't be complaining. The only way they would complain is by not accepting a job as the superintendent of Wallala said. Yes, we have 20 substitute teachers on our list, but only two of them will go to Troy. And partly that's because the longer day and not being provided the plan time. I'd like to, if it's helpful, I'd like to just go down through the bill to explain the structure of our salary. In subsection 1, beginning teachers throughout the state are averaged. And that salary is divided by 190 in order to get the daily rate. And then the percentage of that is 85%. That is the minimum daily rate for a substitute teacher in Oregon. And all of the substitute teachers are licensed by TSPC. The majority of them have had teacher training. And this salary does not include an increment for experience, advanced degrees, or education, which most of them have. In subsection 2, it says the school district shall set the working hours for the substitute teacher. We have never dealt in hours. In our research, you'll notice the hours are just all over the place. So we have stuck to simply salary, half day, and anything more than a half day is a whole day. And in subsection 3, this deals with after 10 days for one teacher, you will become as 100% of a teacher in your district, divided by 190 again to get the daily rate. But if that is lower, you will stay at the substitute teacher rate. And then under B, it explains kinds of days that aren't counted as interruptions to the 10 days. So we come to subsection 4, which is House Bill 2788, which says that for calculating both subsection 1 and subsection 3, we will use 1.25, because that is the addition of instruction that is being performed by the teacher. Then in subsection 5, substitute teachers who are represented in collective bargaining are not covered by this bill. And then the emergency clause, because many of the schools have been 4-day schools for a very long time. If you have this sheet here for our research, these are the schools. We thought in the beginning that we were going to have only about 21, because that was the list we received from the Department of Education, but as we went along, Phyllis Remy and I had the opportunity to call all of these districts and get the information as to when they started, what time the students come and leave the school, what time the substitute teachers are expected to be there, their salary, the teachers' hours, the regular teachers' hours. We found that all of the teachers had the same salary they would have if they were in a 5-day school, that changing to the 4 days didn't change their salary at all. But we also learned that they had a 9-hour day rather than a 10-hour day, which is what we thought they were going to have. So to make up the 40-hour week, they would sometimes have planning time, in-service meetings, tutoring, and other duties on a Friday. Then often we found that instead of 175 student days, 8-hour student days, it would be changed to 155 9-hour student days. Which really didn't give them a chance to do all of the planning. They needed to have planning time on other days that weren't available to the substitute teachers for planning. So what ends up, if we come with the students, that doesn't give us the time It takes me about 45 minutes to plan. And another 45 minutes after school to write up what I've done. And these school districts are being very nice. They're saying, oh, you don't have to stay. It's still an eight-hour day. But we end up doing the work anyway.
Thank you.
Yes. And thank you very much for your support. And if you aren't a co-signer, you were an interested ear for us. One thing I might add to this is that when I would ask...
Oh, can you please introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
I'm Phyllis Remy, and I'm from Salem. I'm a substitute for Salem Schools. Is that there were a few of the contacts which were so friendly and courteous, and it's like, well, they are so proud of their programs, and it's like, I'd like my kid to go here. Sounds good. But as I talked to them and got the report times, it's like, but you're not changing the way you pay your subs, basically, to fit into their new program, is that some, when I asked for report times, would say, well, some of the subs come a half hour early to get keys and look at plans, and so they are, we're acknowledging that the report times were not when the substitutes actually do come or leave particularly. And also one thing concerning the timing of this is that we were so surprised to find that there were just short of 50 districts on the four-day week, and as we read the papers, we're finding that Central here in the Valley and I think up the Canyon are thinking about possibly going to four-day instruction weeks, and that the comment was actually made by one of the superintendents that we're looking to see the way the other districts are doing it, and it's like, well, we really do need to do something now, well, for the current and for the future, possibly.
Thank you very much. And I'm going to ask the last panelist to be very brief because we have several other folks signed up to testify and only a few minutes left.
I can be brief.
Thank you.
Sally Sue Sellers, Sam Hill County Schools. And I would like to commend you for substituting for the chair at the beginning of the meeting. That was very well done. For many years, I substituted in Perrydale School District. And after experiencing the four-day work week, I opted to not go there any longer. And according to our research, 10% of a student time is spent with a substitute teacher during the year, and I'm concerned also that many of these districts now are not attracting the outstanding substitutes that they could, that could be contributing to their educational team. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Representative Thatcher.
No, I just want to apologize for any psychological trauma I may have inflicted upon past substitute teachers. And I want to say I'm sincerely sorry, and I apologize, and I give you the utmost respect.
Any further questions?
I think I had you.
I've had the experience of serving as a substitute teacher many years ago, and many horrific memories, one including some braids and a pair of scissors in a kindergarten classroom, come to mind. And I appreciate the challenge that you have walking into classrooms and serving kids that you haven't yet met. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This deals specifically with four-day weeks, correct?
Yes.
Will we be in a bind if, God forbid, some school districts are forced to go to three-day weeks or three-and-a-half-day weeks? There are schools that are already on four-day weeks. I'm just wondering if we're being too restrictive and we should change it to be, rather than say 4 days, it gets converted to one, multiplied by 1.25. To say if it's a reduction from five, that we adjust accordingly?
Prorated.
Is this?
What if they go to a seven-day week?
Pardon?
What if they go to a six-day week, do we adjust it the other way?
My son will drop out.
Well, I am going to give our other folks that want to testify the chance to come up, mm-hmm. and I am confident that you would all be willing to follow up with Representative Parker on that conversation, and we can...
Yes.
Do you have a response to that question?
Chair Gelser and Representative Parker, I don't... If we were going to keep the instructional hours the same...
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't go to school that long.
Yeah. Okay, not a concern then. I'll take it that as. All righty.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Next we have
Chuck Bennett and David Williams. Thank you. Welcome. And if you'll begin your testimony by stating your name for the record, that would be helpful.
My name is Chuck Bennett. I'm Director of Government Relations for the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2788, one to express our opposition to the bill. We believe this bill represents a 25% pay increase. This is coming at a time when we're facing $600 to $800 million in lost general fund revenue over the next biennium. This bill would cost small districts, by its own estimate, $443,000 during the next biennium, an annual loss of about $222,000. And this is losses to small school districts who really, in looking at them, just frankly can't afford the impact of changes like this. We understand that in an absolute great economy with things going well, if we were going somewhere besides down $600 to $800 million, this kind of thing is worth talking about in terms of an equity. But we're beyond equity here, Madam Chair, in the future. This bill represents the kind of bills that I think come out of thinking from, I don't know, 8 months ago, 12 months ago, before it all kind of fell apart in the economy. And frankly, we'd ask you not to proceed with this bill. I don't know how some of these districts are going to deal with the shortfalls they're facing. To add to that shortfall seems unreasonable. The bottom line, Madam Chair, and I think it was pointed out by the folks testifying ahead of us, the proponents of the bill, if you choose not to work in a four-day-a-week system, you won't be paid under a four-day-a-week system, and that's what we'd suggest to them is do not accept the assignments in four-day-week systems. Look only for the five-day-week system if that's what they're after. But the reason our districts are going to four-day weeks is they're trying to save money in order to try to deal with these substantial losses they're facing. So we'd ask you to please not move this bill forward. Thank you.
David.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, David Williams with the Oregon School Boards Association. Just to echo Mr. Bennett's comments, again, to highlight the impact being isolated to these small districts who, again, the reason they went to this type of system is to save revenues. You know, you're looking down the list here, the biggest districts are places like Winston-Dillard and Morro County School District. You know, 2,000 kids is the largest district on the list. So we're really looking at an isolated impact on the smallest districts in the state. To put it in perspective, on the big numbers that we deal with on the state level, it's equivalent to about $8 million a year impact if you were to sort of take the per student impact on these small districts so that you can have a perspective on say the state school fund, or about a $16 million impact to biennium. That's sort of the scope of the impact that these districts will feel as a result of this increase in cost to them.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. So I have a couple of questions. So when the school districts that made the decision to go to four-day weeks, was it part of the conversation that this would be a way to save money because they could pay substitutes less than if they had been on a five-day week?
Madam Chair, Representative Dembro, I doubt that it was part of the conversation. I suspect the conversation dealt more with utility bills and other factors, transportation costs. Those would be the big ticket items. What I don't think they expect is to have that kind of decision essentially overturned in a legislative you know, in a fix like this, by changing their payment rates to substitutes, to see their savings eaten up in payments to substitute teachers in a 25% pay increase.
Mm-hmm. And follow up: are any of the districts that have gone to 4-day weeks voluntarily paying their substitutes at an equitable rate?
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough, they may well be. That if we just received this, I tried to make a couple of calls, and I just came to the realization when you're on a 4-day week, you're not in Friday, and that. So,
especially Friday.
So we're finding that generally the calls I make, apparently people are honoring the 4-day week.
Thanks.
I couldn't rouse anybody but a talking machine.
Thanks, Chuck. And
you bet.
Can I follow up? Some of the schools that are on 4-day districts that are on 4-day weeks have collective bargaining or not, and how is that being handled? There's a reference to that in the bill. You don't think any of them have collective bargaining? And here we're talking about collective bargaining for substitutes, where they're a bargaining unit.
Madam Chair, Representative Dembrough, I think in the testimony by the Substitute Teachers Association, they reference there are three districts with collective bargaining agreements for the substitutes: Portland, Beaverton, and Eugene, I think, was the other one.
And how are they handling this? Do you know?
They're not 4-day week. Are they?
They're
not 4-day week
course.
School districts. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So in one of these districts, for a substitute teacher who has a week-long assignment, to go from 5-day week to a 4-day week is a 20% reduction in compensation. Correct?
Okay. They're working 20% less.
Yeah. So is anyone else in these school districts having their compensation reduced by 20% as they move from a 5-day to a 4-day week?
Madam Chair, Representative Parker, I believe there would be commensurate reductions for the bulk of our classified employees in those districts, as they are generally hourly employees, and therefore they would not be paid for their time not worked on, say, a Friday.
Is anyone who is performing a similar function, teaching of kids, seeing a 20% reduction in compensation?
Madam Chair, Representative Harker, I would anticipate that, and if you look down the dates of implementation, there is a wide discrepancy on when these districts move to this type of model. I would imagine that, as necessitated by the impacts, that most of these districts opened up their collective bargaining agreements and negotiated the impact of moving to a 4-day school week. As was testified, it's not as simple as the same total number of hours in 4 days. It's actually fewer hours because you're increasing your instructional time. You're reducing your sort of non-instructional time and increasing your instructional time in those 4 days. So those districts would have negotiated the impact, and I think it very well reasonably expected that in some instances where these districts are really on the margin, they did achieve some sort of wage reduction among their teaching corps to move to that 4-day week. I would imagine also in others they did not see a reduction in salary for their teachers.
Follow-up?
Thanks. I understand we're all going to get slapped around a bit here as we go through this transition. I think it should be equitable. And if what I'm looking for is equitable treatment of people delivering similar services, and maybe we could tie this to an individual school district, if they decide that the teachers are taking a 15% whack, so that means substitute teachers and regular teachers as well. But for one population, a subset of the teachers, to bear the brunt of it, doesn't seem fair to me.
Thank you, Representative Thatcher.
I'll pass. Representative Harker addressed it.
We're always like this.
I know.
Are there any further questions for this panel? Representative Van Orman.
Yeah, I got it.
I'm sitting here because, as I intimated earlier, I was one of those people as a substitute teacher, and we were paid on a daily rate. So apparently this has changed. As if I worked 4 days, I got paid for 4 days. So, and that's still it?
Madam Chair, Representative Van Orman, you are, the way we, for substitute teachers who work in a school district for which there is no collective bargaining agreement for the substitutes, those three school districts, you are paid based on a statutory rate, which is essentially a per-day rate. And if you work less than 2 weeks, you are paid, I believe it's 85% of the per-day rate of the average teacher in the state of Oregon. And if you work more than 2 weeks, then you are paid the full per-day amount.
Yeah, it's 100.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else that wishes to be heard? Seeing none, I am closing the hearing on House Bill 2788. And have I closed all of the public hearings that are open? Thank you all very much. Have a great weekend. And the House Committee on Education is adjourned. May I?